David Reif is a journalist, writer, and policy analyst. He's one of the leading observers of global affairs in the area, certainly of humanitarian projects and international systems. His many books include At the Point of a Gun, Democratic Dreams and Armed Intervention, A Bed for the Night, Humanitarianism in Crisis, and The Reproach of Hunger, Food, Justice, and Money in the 21st Century. His new book has a simple title and subtitle, Desire and Fate. That's our topic today. Welcome, Mr. Reif.
Thank you.
We get right to the book. You begin by asserting that we are in the middle of a, quote, cultural revolution, one that differs from previous cultural revolutions, such as that in China in the mid-20th century, in that it pushes what you call a contradictory synthesis. What are the components of this current revolutionary synthesis?
Well, I think it combines, the novelty that we have now is that woke, if you want to call it identitarianism, the various forms of what we generally, for lack of a better term, call woke, diversity, the DEI stuff, the whole sort of package, is on the one hand incredibly radical, and in another way doesn't threaten anything. And that's the big difference. The Maoists destroyed high culture, high Confucian culture, but they didn't keep the same economic system that the high Confucian culture had flourished under. Whereas the paradox of woke is that there does, at first, it seemed as if woke were a radical break with the capitalist order, with the neoliberal order. And certainly there are plenty of people on college campuses, people who identify themselves with all these, to my mind, dreadful ideas, who think of themselves as revolutionary and think they're working inside the belly of the beast. And if you read, you know, any of the journals, all of which have been basically hijacked, the professional journals, basically all of which have been hijacked in one form or another, whether it's anthropology, psychology, sociology, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. My poor father is a sociologist. As Randy Newman said of Karl Marx, he'd be glad he was dead. What happened to his field. But what, even though these people construe themselves as revolutionaries, and a guy like Robin Kelly at UCLA talks about racial capitalism.
He was my colleague at Emory University for a few years in the 90s.
My condolences. the whole idea is idiotic. You write a book about capitalism and you only have the Atlantic Triangle and Asia doesn't exist. I mean, the whole thing is preposterous. But particularly you write it now when Asian capitalism is in the ascendant and all you want to do is look backwards. I think these people, most of them, have really swallowed their own Kool-Aid. But what's radically interesting about them and why I wrote this book is that I think the difference is, as I say, that to come back to the point about Confucianism and Maoism, when the Cultural Revolution destroyed what was left of Confucian culture, what had been left between the late 40s when the Maoists took over China and when the Cultural Revolution started in the early mid-60s, they weren't maintaining the old Confucian economic system. They had a communist system. These people think themselves great revolutionaries, but operate entirely inside the frame of neoliberalism. I don't know if I say in the book or I've said it somewhere that all this woke stuff on college campuses, it's like the testing kitchen for woke light, which is going to be what J.P. Morgan Chase and Raytheon, and for that matter, all these institutions of the U.S. government that, whatever you think of Elon Musk, he's been extraordinary in rooting out all the degree to which not just institutions we already knew were completely dominated by these ideas, like the Department of Education or the Health and Human Services world, but the National Security Agency and the CIA and the FBI, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, institutions you never would have thought of as being vulnerable to these ideas. Yeah. But they have a version of this idea, what you could call woke light, which challenges everything cultural and nothing economic.
You know, something, I'm gonna let you keep talking, but I have to, that is a very good formulation. They challenge everything. Say that again. Everything cultural and nothing economic.
They challenge everything cultural and absolutely nothing economic. They're entirely comfortable with the current economic system, provided that it becomes more racially, sexually, I can't quite bear to use the word gender, but one has to, that the marginalized get a seat at the table, which is why this wonderful old line, hard line, old left guy, Adolf Reed Jr., who was my father's colleague at Penn for many years, I'm sure you knew, he said that really the project of woke, and he's again speaking from almost a Stalinist perspective, he said the project of woke is to diversify the ruling class. So as far as these people are concerned, in the woke light world, I'm talking about the people who are in all these consultancies, and one should never underestimate what I'd call the Willie Sutton element. Remember the 1950s bank robber, Willie Sutton?
Right, right.
And he caught him. He said, they asked him why he robbed banks. He said that was where the money was. And, you know, to some extent, the woke thing is simply that's where you get your grants. And because these institutions have indeed been now dominated by people who see the world in this way. But nothing about them. There's no problem, as there would have been in, you couldn't have done what I'm sure half the people in these university campuses, and certainly the people in human resources departments all over capitalist America, and even to some extent, the U.S. for all it's wrong here is a lot less captured than Australia or Canada or Ireland or the U.K. I'm not a great fan of Donald Trump's, but I certainly thought what Vance said in Munich was entirely correct, and what they said to Starmer when he came to see them in Washington the other day, yesterday, the day before, whenever. This will be taping later, but when during Starmer's state visit, the UK Prime Minister, it's worse there, but it's a system where, in the real world, you can have all these ideas that there has to be practically numerical proportional representation of every group. And in an increasingly atomized society where we're not just a few racial groups and gay and straight, but we're 17 different genders and any number of races. And so those people who in the mainstream, once they get out of the test kitchen of the universities and some of the other, and the cultural institutions, the museums, the philanthropies, they can, as long as you're the right color, there's no problem meeting with your stockbroker.
Right. You know, let me ask you, is that capacity of, cultural revolutionary, economically neoliberal, are they in this contradictory position just because works for them? I mean, is it a very personal, individualistic matter of advantage? I like my job. I like being part of the ruling elite. This is a shtick, or is it more than just selfishness?
I think it's both. I think the basic thing is these ideas are very powerful. And they explain the world in a way that both threatens everything and nothing. You get people want the fantasy of being a revolutionary is an old fantasy in the West. It's a fantasy by the way, that was very much promulgated by Silicon Valley at the beginning. The Apple advertisements in the early period of Apple were all about make your own revolution and all the rest of it. And in a certain point, what's happened is the radical individualism of contemporary capitalist society morphed into radical communitarianism or blockism. And so that you have everybody is representing their group. It's interesting because there is a precedent for this, but not in the United States, which is the great Mexican educator and philosopher and a social theorist, Jose Vasconcelos, who's one of the principal ideologues of the Mexican Revolution, or the second part of it, and founds the National University of Mexico, et cetera, et cetera. His great slogan was, "For my race, my spirit will speak." But the thing is, he only had one race in mind. And whereas now it's everybody, it's this Tower of Babel of various identities, all of whom demand to be represented as a group. So I think these are powerful ideas. It validates people. It does. At the same time, look, I don't want to be naive. Once this system is in place, then that's where the money is, as I was saying earlier about Willie Sutton and right. People, it's a good, and also you're appointing your friends and you're doing what, groups always do, which is put the group interest first and the guy you went to school with and the person you were on you were in whatever, some institution or group. And I think, so I think it's both. But I do think they're sincere. I think it's completely demented from all sorts of points of view, but I don't think it's a grift.
Yeah.
I mean, they're grifters in every world, but sure. I don't think it's more of a grift than any other.
Yeah, I think, to call it a grift is kind of the easy critique, right? Yeah. And I think we do need to be more serious about it than that. As you move on the book, you mentioned this a few minutes ago about high culture. What is the problem with high culture to the woke world? Why is it a target?
Because it's hard. Because not everyone's going to do it, be able to do it. Schoenberg says somewhere, if it's for everyone, it's not art. If it's not, if it's art, it's not for everyone. If it's for everyone, it's not art. And I think that's what eye culture is. It requires some effort to listen even to the most delightful of classical composers like Mozart or Telemann or Purcell or somebody of those people. Forget about the really hard people. It takes no effort whatsoever to listen to Taylor Swift. Everybody can do that. You barely have to be conscious to listen to Taylor Swift and enjoy it. I mean, it's a sugar rush.
Well, not even, one thing that a taste experience cultivation of high culture does is it makes you want to close your ears and eyes when you go out in public space. Way too often. It's a curse.
Oh, absolutely. No, but it is a curse. And, if one allows oneself to despair, which I certainly think nobody's got their head is paying any attention at all, could avoid doing at least 10 times a day, mm-hmm. Given this, the cultural collapse. Because again, I'll come back to this, but I don't think capitalism is in any danger whatsoever. I think all these people who talk about late capitalism in the sort of the old Marxist press. I think to the contrary, I think capitalism's incredibly healthy and more likely than ever to be it'll disappear eventually like every other economic system, but none of us will be alive to see that. But whereas culture is on its high culture, what people like you or I think of as culture is on its deathbed at best.
Yeah. You said in the book, you recall 1993 when you called multiculturalism That was the word back then, yeah, right? You called multiculturalism, quote, capitalism's silent partner. Now, there were a couple of voices later, maybe Thomas Frank would go in there.
Yeah, but he was did very you feel, good on that.
But did you feel at that time, you know, a voice in the wilderness?
Oh, sure. Nobody, everyone thought I was insane. But it just seemed to me so blindingly obvious that that this kind of multiculturalism was great for consumer capitalism, because you got the ideal, many, many, many more markets. The marketer's dream, market segmentation. So, and it was actually provoked, I don't think I put it in that piece that I did for Harper's back before Harper's lost its mind, but anyway, that's another conversation. I was in Greenwich Village, and there was a sign, which at the time seemed quite noticeable. Today, you wouldn't notice it at all. It would be practically like an invitation to a Carthusian monastery. It was a big billboard for gay holidays. And it was two guys sort of sitting with, I don't know, pina coladas in their hand, I don't know, on some beach somewhere. And I thought, right, okay, that's great for the airlines. You get to sell a whole new bunch of holiday packages. You get to gear it. It's market segmentation. It expands your market and it also probably lets you get to higher end consumption. And so it seemed to me that there was nothing, despite all the anti-capitalist blather in the multicultural world, there was actually nothing incompatible. And of course, it seems to me that the woke phenomenon is that on steroids, because in fact, as you know, as we all know, the woke people talk about anything but class. And of course, if they were to talk about class, the people who rule would come down, I mean, the capitalist world would not try to co-opt them and make a kind of woke light for themselves. They would oppose it fiercely, and they have the means to oppose it if they were to have chosen to.
Wow. I mean,
the banks and the brokerage firms and all the rest didn't have to give in to this stuff. They decided it was no threat to them, and that seemed to be the way things were moving. So they gave in. Now, whether the Trump administration's, for all my unhappiness with and my dislike, frankly, for Trump, I do tend to agree with them on these matters. And I hope that even as they do lots of other things I will hate, particularly in Ukraine, where I'm speaking to you from at the moment, and I'm very apprehensive about what Trump will do and about his love of dictators like Mr. Putin and Mr. Xi. But
David, let me interrupt you quickly. Why don't you tell our listeners quickly where they can find your writings on the current situation?
Well, I'm writing a book about Ukraine, but I'm basically teaching here. I do this stuff about the culture criticism on a Substack, which is called, God help me because I screwed up some technical thing. It's called Desire and Fate 2. You have to put the two Roman ones there because the first one I got locked out of at some point and I'm sort of rebuilding it. And I write about the culture criticism stuff there. I do a bit on Ukraine. I did a piece on Trump and the election of the new German chancellor, Friedrich Merz, in the New Republic a few days ago. It's on their website. It's a very savage piece about Trump. But I also teach here in Kiev. They gave me an honorary professorship, which I had the bad taste to take as if they'd given me a real professorship.
Okay.
Obviously. So I teach different things. Everything from American literature to media studies, whatever people really want me to do.
Good.
And I'm interested, particularly, I have a project here, which is there's a site right outside of Kiev where the NKVD buried about 30,000 people they killed in the late 1930s in Kiev, and then they trucked them out to this forest, which is about, oh, I don't know, 10, 12 miles outside of Kiev in the suburbs, really. And the site was rediscovered by some dissidents in the 60s, then it was covered up again, et cetera. It's still, though, the sort of unloved stepchild of martyred Ukraine. You can go to Babi Yar, you can go to Bucha, where the Russians massacred all these people recently. But this place is very ignored, so I've been working on that. But the cultural stuff is in this Desire and Fate, too, I still write about.
You mentioned a moment ago, you talked about, you know, this movement on steroids. And in the book, you actually say that the woke movement wants to, quote, politicize everything. And we've heard that before, but they also want to, you say this, moralize everything. Isn't this just exhausting to most people? I mean, can people live with that? Just
I assume that's why Donald Trump got elected. I mean, for the most part. I mean, leaving aside that, you know, that they covered up disgracefully Biden's and, you know, being no longer a poor man compass, and that Harris was a lousy candidate. I'm told I don't have any inside knowledge of any of this, although I did think Trump was going to win, because when I saw that the poll said it was a tie, since we know that right-leaning voters lie to pollsters for perfectly reasonable causes, I figured Trump must be about to win. Not that I know anything particularly. I know particular context. I know a couple of people I'm in contact with a few people in the administration. But I assume that, I mean, people say, for example, that ad that they ran, which is Kamala Harris is for they, them, Trump's for you, was incredibly effective. And I think people are fed up with it. But on the other hand, these bureaucracies are so powerful and so entrenched, and all the professional groups have largely been taken over to the point where you have trans, which I have to tell you, I mean, I write about trans. I'm not at all persuaded that trans women are women. In fact, I don't believe that for a second. But I mean, unless they've literally had a sex change in the way when you and I were young, you know, you had people who actually had full-scale sex changes. Sure, those people are women.
Renee Richards.
But I think Jan Morris or Christine Jorgensen were women, to speak of people from the ancient world. But I think somebody who has a penis cannot be called a woman, but they do. And that part of it, I do think I understood something about woke, about this racial stuff, about the representative stuff, but I don't actually understand how trans has triumphed. That, I have to say, is a mystery to me. And it's much worse, obviously, in other parts of the world than it is here. I mean, Scotland, this poor nurse who just was having a very deep menstrual flow, as women often do just before menopause. They reach the age of menopause, and she was there bleeding, and some guy walks in a dress. And she said, please leave. And he said, no, I have the right to be here. I'm a woman. And the National Health Service in Scotland sided with him. They disciplined her. She took it, thanks to this wonderful group that Toby Young runs in the UK called the Free Speech Union. They helped her to take it to an employment court. She may yet win, but so far at least, the social, the Scots National Party, which is the ruling party in Scotland in the regional assembly, they're completely supporting the trans stuff. They're not backing down an inch. Will they be punished at the ballot box? I don't know. I mean, I don't know enough about politics of Scotland to say that. But what strikes me is how strongly people are willing to hold on to these ideas, even when they're challenged.
Is it one thing you mentioned, how so much of the arguments are now offered in a, quote, medicalized vocabulary? You talk about that in the book. The medicalized vocabulary is very hard to overcome, right? I mean, the authority of doctors, and this is health. This is it's not a political vocabulary, which is much more contestable. Would you say that?
Absolutely. No, I think both woke and the human rights movement have tried to leapfrog over politics. Human rights movement by saying, we're not ideological. We just want the laws to be obeyed, as if the laws weren't in themselves a political and ideological and moral documents that can be contested, can be challenged, can be questioned. You can, but they, you know, the human rights movement was I think, a very mistaken effort to depoliticize the debate over human rights, the ideological debate over human rights. And the same thing with this medicalized language of identitarianism, of gender, of woke generally. Just again, it's not a very satisfactory term, but no one's come up with a better one. Certainly I haven't. But I think also that's another reason you said before, you pointed out before that, you know, the question is, are these people sincere, or should we think of it much more as careerism of various kinds of, or at least should we think that's a really important element? I think that the reason, one of the reasons woke has been so successful is that we're obsessed with wellness. On a certain level, I see the woke phenomenon as a political mutation of the wellness movement, in which you're just always, everything, your obsession is your state of being. And then as that, there's this wonderful left-wing, old-style left-wing psychologist or psychiatrist, I don't know which, at the New School, God help him, the poor man, called Eli Zaretsky. And he points out that, you know, the whole politicization of psychotherapy, of psychoanalysis, is saying that everything comes from the outside. You don't have any deep inner problems. Your inner problems are really just manifestations of the oppression that you experienced from the outside. And so actually what's really important is changing the outside, not confronting all the things Freud told us we unfortunately were stuck with.
We've gone from the triumph of the therapeutic to the triumph of the traumatic, as you put it.
I owe a lot to my father. It's very curious. My father wrote this book in which he, The Uses of Faith After Freud is the subtitle of that book, and which I think it's the book of his that means the most to me, whether, I don't know if it's his best book or.
I think it holds up.
But it holds up awfully well. And actually I was just over, because I function in Spanish, a university, a private university in Chile is doing a retranslation in Spanish of the thing, of the book. And I was, so I reread it and I was helping out a little bit with the translation. And his idea basically was that the therapeutic had replaced, had become the organizing principle of how people understood themselves in the world. And I think we've gone the next step. And I actually, that is my next book, is a book that I'm going to call, with all suitable salams and obeisances to my father, The Triumph of the Traumatic. Because I think the what's happened is we moved from a therapeutic culture, which was still individualist. I mean, he was writing about people, in a therapeutic relation with themselves and their societies. Now it's all about trauma. And so it's very strange. I found, even though, you know, my parents, my mother's in Sontag, my father, Philip Reif, they were thought of and probably construed themselves as in opposition to each other. But I find his ideas about the therapeutic, and which I'm transposing or moving to the next, what I think is the next step, which is this culture of the traumatic. And my mother's critique of the metaphorization of things actually have more in common than I think either of them supposed, or certainly I supposed until I really started thinking about these issues. Because the traumatic part is saying that basically anything, everything is from the outside happening to you. You're traumatized by your history, usually of oppression or lack of the ability to live the life as you want. So you don't actually want to lose your penis, but you want to live as a woman. What I mean, again, I come back to, but trans, I do think I understand something about woke. The trans thing just baffles me. It appalls me, but it baffles me, and I don't pretend to understand why it's so powerful. But here you talk about trauma, inherited trauma, which is a very questionable neurologically. I mean, some people think it's true. There's a movement in the Black African-American radical public health world about what they call weathering, which they say you age quicker because of all the oppression you suffer, which they don't mean the part of that that's true, because obviously there's a kernel of truth in it, which is that when there are no supermarkets in the neighborhood, people don't eat as well because they can't afford the better food in the bodegas or whatever that replace the supermarkets when the supermarkets leave. But they don't mean that. They mean the pressure, the trauma of living in a racist society makes people age psychologically. So, and you know, so everything is explained in terms of trauma. And the goal, this is where I think it connects to the wellness movement. This takes place in a society absolutely obsessed with its own health. Neurotically obsessed with its own health, with not just with aging, that's an old story, but with that, with how you know every bit of you is being or not being optimized, and that's crosses. That's not just woke. I mean, people like the right wing guys in Silicon Valley, like Musk and Peter Thiel and the others, are obsessed with, you know, they've been obsessed with these questions of prolonging life and various experiments to see if there are ways of extending the lifespan, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's a culture-wide phenomenon. Again, what my father would have called post-Protestant. But the other side, which is the side that I think where my mother's ideas about metaphor, it's very strange to be writing a book that in effect tries to synthesize these two monstre sacré, is that what she said in Illness is Metaphor, in her two books on illness, what kind of metaphor, I call Illness is Metaphor, the first one, and then, which is about really based on her own cancer and the first cancer, and then the book on AIDS and its metaphors, is that actually to metaphorize real things is to do them a great, to distort them, to do them a great disservice. So that in the context of what the woke, about the things that I'm concerned with traumatic, this triumph of the traumatic, it seems to me that once you say that verbal violence is violence, which is one of their slogans, or that silence is violence. You see that often in the demonstrations, in the pro-Palestinian demonstrations on college campuses in the last year. And you probably saw it before. But of course, that's not true. Or rather, if silence is violence and psychological, if these things that aren't violence are violence, then what's violence? Then it's everything. Then you are just this person who's being buffeted by the winds of your oppression, and your health is at risk. And that, of course, again, I think is where the wellness stuff comes in, because there's nothing worse than risking your health. That's the one thing you're not supposed to do. Except the drugs you're supposed to be allowed to take, of course, because there are all kinds of internal contradictions that people don't want to talk about. But the basic idea is, when you metaphorize oppression, where everything is oppression, being ignored is oppression, being paid attention to is oppression. Well, then you've all these meaning, you know, that the terms lose their meaning, and we're deep in you know, basically the end of meaning.
Well, I think that you're absolutely right. I think there's a great deal of power intoxication that comes with being the instrument of that confusion. Of, I mean, it shakes people. It keeps others uncertain. You know, what you were able to say last year, you can't say this year anymore. It puts people off balance, and some people like to have everyone else in the room off balance. Anyway,
they fantasize about. I mean, I think the woke people, I don't think they understand the society they live in because they can't face the reality that neoliberalism is doing just fine. Thank you very much. Hmm. And that you know, it's not going, there's no, you know, late capitalism is sort of wishful thinking of the worst and most childish kind.
The workers, the utopia is just around the corner if we only get rid of the bad people, David.
Yeah, well, that's it. Well, that's where the Cultural Revolution stuff comes in. That's where, the people have to be. Of course, people are not being killed. They're not being tortured. They're not the things the Maoists did were, you know, and they probably killed a million people and sent another 20 million to work camps for years and years and years. So one has to be careful. I mean, this is Cultural Revolution light. But having said that, the commissar-like quality of that you see in documentary films of the Cultural Revolution time, or films, raw footage of humiliation of bourgeois officials or public officials who haven't towed the line. When you see these young people in college campuses and elsewhere breaking up meetings in universities and the like, they have the same sense of complete. They're stoned on their own virtue.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's what people are right now. And that's a very, virtue is a really heady drug if you think you've got it. Because
sure.
It's not just, because it does, I think people, and look, we live in a time, and this has nothing to do with the left or woke culture, we live in a time of hyperbole. We live that, I mean, that goes back just to advertising. That has nothing to do with left, right, or any of those things. But this is the best cheese, this is the best car, whatever, all these things that are basically lies of one kind or another. They don't perhaps do any harm in some contexts, and they do a lot of harm in others. But think of the hyperbole of liberals about Trump. And again, I speak as someone who's very worried about Trump in terms of the world. I will, and I don't mind if people who like me on the more liberal side are angry. That's their problem, not mine. I think Vance was right in Munich to talk about the erosion of civil liberties in Europe. I think what the hard time they gave Starmer when he came to the White House, Vance and Trump, was great. I think some of these attacks on DEI have been wildly long overdue. I'm not sure they'll work, but I hope they do, frankly.
Yeah.
I hope they, but having said that, when you think of that's just an aside about Trump and Vance, but think of the way liberals talk with a straight face of being in the resistance, as if they were Jean Moulin in Lyon, 1942. I mean, you can't believe what you're reading. The resistance to people, you were talking about the Upper West Side before, Central Park West, a very fat TIA Cref account, and you're in the resistance. You see, that's where the economics, and economics is the ghost at the banquet. Because, of course, if they had to talk about class, rather than race,
they got to look in the mirror.
They'd have to look in the mirror, and when they actually met their brokers, and hopefully the broker is trans and Chicano and three other things, but the broker is still the broker. That's precisely Adolf Schreed's point about the diversification of the ruling class.
Yeah.
They wouldn't feel so good. But as long as you keep the economy, as long as you keep the ghost at the banquet a ghost, you're okay. and things can go on. And you really can have your moral cake and your, and also your capitalist pie. And it's kind of, you can see why it's attractive. Of course it's attractive.
Indeed.
It's not so, it, you know, but again, look at the hiring stuff. These public school systems are being in the big American cities where the kids can't read, they can't do simple arithmetic, and they've got 3 DEI people in the education department's headquarters downtown who are getting
fat salaries.
Yeah, fat six-figure salaries, and who are no threat of being laid off. When they lay off the music teacher, they're not laying off those people. And so that's, you can only do that when you say that everything's important except material reality.
The book title brings us back to where it's all heading. It's called Desire and Fate. We've spoken, we've gone over time, but I think I could listen to you, David, for another hour. But for now, the book is Desire and Fate. David Reif, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Conversations. First Things is a reader-supported publication. To support our work, access our articles, and subscribe to the monthly print edition, please visit firstthings.com today.